This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are now in the 12th month of war in Eastern Europe. It was February 24th last year when Russia began a series of attacks on its neighbor, Ukraine. It initially made a push for eastern regions and the capital city of Kyiv, but heavy and effective resistance from the Ukrainians eventually prompted Russia to scale back those ambitions, at least temporarily, and fighting has mostly been in the east, with intermittent strikes across the country. All this is arguably a major escalation of a war that actually started back in 2014 when Russia took over Crimea. But the late consequences have been severe. Millions of people have fled Ukraine and millions more have been displaced internally in what has been described as the largest refugee crisis in Europe since World War II. A good number of those refugees have come to America and even here in Illinois. Beyond that, thousands have been killed, both soldiers and civilians. Meanwhile, the U.S. has been gradually stepping up its involvement, most recently pledging to send Abrams tanks and support equipment. Joining us now to talk about all this and more is Jordan Ganz Morse. He's an associate professor at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois, where he's also faculty director of the Russian, Eurasian, and East European Studies program. Jordan, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thanks for having me.
As ever, listeners, you can join our conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. Do you think the war in Ukraine will continue long into 2023 and beyond? What do you think of the U.S. role in the war so far? Should it continue supporting Ukraine? Or should we put a cap on our aid, as some in Congress are suggesting? 800-222-9455 is the number to call. That's 800-222-9455, or tweet us at 21st Show. So, Jordan, from a broad perspective, where are we in this war?
Well, currently, it's something of a lull while we wait for both sides to figure out what comes next in terms of planned offensives that are going to come fairly soon, potentially, but certainly by this spring. That's why the story about the tanks that Germany has now agreed to both send to Ukraine and allow other countries such as Poland that have these German tanks that have been waiting for permission to send them, they are now going to be allowed to send them. And as you mentioned, the U.S. is going to be sending some of our tanks. And that's why this is critical, because we're on the verge of a moment where Ukraine's going to try to launch a significant additional counteroffensive and push Russia out of the Donbas. At the same time, Russia has been mobilizing thousands and thousands of troops. This started back in the fall, but they sent a lot of them just immediately into Ukraine, almost with no training, in a really horrific situation, just to basically stem the bleeding. Now they're claiming that they have troops that are actually going to be trained and are going to be sent this spring for their own offensive to start all over with a larger attack.
Well, let's dig into some of those particulars there. You mentioned the German tanks, but the U.S. Tanks came first. I understand that was sort of like meant to break the dam of the German tanks. Maybe we can just take a step back and talk about some of the machinations and calculations that went into this arguably an escalation of aid from the West to Ukraine.
That's my understanding as well, is that the U.S. decision was strategic. Germany has this has been a pattern ever since Russia invaded last February. Germany has, at the end of the day, been willing to get behind Ukraine, but only after a lot of hemming and hawing, and only after a lot of pushing from its allies, and only with a lot of political cover. And there's lots of reasons for this. And my expertise lies more in Russia and Ukraine than in Germany. But in terms of German politics, there's current issues in terms of coalition partners, and there's also, of course, the historic issues in terms of the Soviet Union and Germany having fought these horrific battles, including specifically, if we're talking symbolically, tank battles in World War II. So Germany's wanted political cover, and that was essentially what the U.S. was trying to give it. Germany, for whatever reasons, felt that they did not want to be seen by Russia as being the first to give the okay or to send their tanks, or to be the first to send directly their tanks into Ukraine. By the U.S. agreeing to do that first, they could at least say, all we're doing is following what other major countries are doing. The one caveat here is the reason the U.S. was hesitant wasn't so much that the U.S. was against pushing for more tanks by this point. It's taken a long time to get to this point where the U.S. is comfortable sending tanks, and I'd be happy to talk about why it's taken so long. But it was more that it was not seen logistically that the U.S. tanks, the Abrams, were the right tank to be sending to Ukraine for a number of reasons. The German Leopards were the ones that were seen to be much more effective.
Yeah, well, I mean, among many things I've been reading about this is that the American tanks get, I think it's 3 gallons per mile of gas. So I guess that's 0.3 gallons or 0.3 miles per gallon. And the German tanks are like 6 times more effective. So they can go 2 miles on a gallon of gas. And there's support equipment. And I guess the German tanks are just closer, right? Because they're in Europe.
Yeah, and if I understand correctly as well, that the U.S. tanks run on something like jet fuel, they really are, you know, from what I understand, that they're remarkable tanks. For a whole number of reasons, aside from getting them there, I think that one of the biggest issues of what military experts have been saying about this is that it's not just a question of training Ukrainians to use them. Ukrainians have shown remarkable capability to integrate all sorts of weapons, including very advanced technology, while they're in the middle of a war, getting technology from multiple different countries that doesn't necessarily, you know, fit together and finding ways to fit together. But with tanks, it's not just a question of getting the tank crews to use them and understand how to use them and training them up. It's a question of having a whole gigantic supply chain and logistical chain to get the right fuel there, to get the right parts there, to get mechanics who are trained to deal with this equipment. And that was the fear, was that these are tanks that would take a lot longer to build all those chains, whereas the Leopards were something that could be done much more quickly and much more easily.
Yeah. Abrams tank is not my Toyota minivan, which is relatively maintenance free.
That's my understanding. Yes.
Yeah. All right. So why, you mentioned this, why has the U.S. moved so slowly, right? We started with artillery and some of the missile systems or supposedly air defense systems, although they can be used to fire at targets on the ground, I gather. Now we're into armor. There's calls, and there have been calls for air power. The Ukraine would like F-16s. Why has the U.S. Escalated slowly here?
Two reasons. The first has been fear of escalation, by giving too much too quickly to Ukraine, it could prompt Russia to either expand the war with some sort of direct attack on a NATO country, or escalate in the sense of fearing that if it's going to lose, it needs to do something dramatic, such as some sort of nuclear attack on Ukraine, whether that be a direct attack on a city or on troops, or whether that be something like an attack with an explosion in the air, just to shock and awe, essentially. Those were the escalation fears that have been there. And throughout the war, it's been a question of, well, is there a red line? And each time it seems like that red line might get reached, Russia doesn't respond in that way. And so the threshold gets pushed further and the debate starts over. That's part one. I understand the arguments. I understand the concern. I do think it's been taken very seriously by the Biden administration. I think it's a misguided argument for a whole number of reasons. But the argument that I think is more sound and has been, you know, part two of this, has been at the beginning of this war, most people, certainly in Russia and most of the analysts in the West, were pretty convinced that Moscow would be able to roll into large parts of the country pretty quickly. And if certain technology were there, say that we put, you know, Patriot missiles in Kyiv, around Kyiv, before February, that would all be technology that would just be that would be captured and it could be back engineered and so on. And so there's been this, you know, two issues, the escalation thing, but the second has just been the practicality of understanding what can be sent into Ukraine that can be currently used in a good way without being captured. And as Ukraine has pushed Russia back and changed the dynamics of the war, at each stage, the U.S. and its allies have said, okay, now we're looking at something different. Javelins made sense before. Now, you know, clearly, Ukraine showed they can push Russia back. Now they need to go on the offensive. They need artillery. Now that makes sense because Russia's on its heels. It's not pressing forward anymore, and so on. And we're at the, you know, the next stage of that, as you said, past artillery to tanks, and maybe we'll be in a future stage soon about air power, where we're able to say clearly, Ukraine, if we give them these weapons, they're going to use them responsibly, and they're going to stay in Ukrainian hands, not in Russian hands.
If you're just joining us, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Jordan Gantz-Morse, who's on the political science faculty at Northwestern University. He's an associate professor there, also faculty director of the Russian, Eurasian, and East European Studies Program. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation, or you can email us anytime, talk@21stshow.org, talk@21stshow.org. All right, we've been talking about America's sort of gradual escalation here. Do you see this as simply a short-term investment in Ukraine's ability to win this war, or is there a longer play here on the part of the U.S. and other NATO allies in terms of strengthening Ukraine in this way?
Absolutely. This is not just at this point a short-term investment in the war. This is a major shift in the way that the U.S. and NATO looks at European security, and more broadly, the way that I think foreign policy specialists look at the state of geopolitics in the world. I mean, I think we entered a fundamentally different era on February 24th of 2022 when Russia showed that in the European theater, it is no longer the same world that we were in basically since the end of World War II, where boundaries were going to be respected, where borders were going to be respected, where there was a sense of what is legitimate and illegitimate actions among the great powers of the world. All that was shattered, and we went, you know, from this world that we had been in since 9/11, where the U.S. had been focused primarily on non-state actors and on terrorism, to back to a world where the U.S. was already worried about China, but now was genuinely and seriously worried about Russia. And so Ukraine's at the heart of that for obvious reasons, and it will be for the foreseeable future, even if and when there's a way to bring this war to a close. Ukraine is going to be that buffer state between Europe and Russia, and it's going to have to be the linchpin of any strategy going forward.
And you just imagine if the U.S. had tried to send this sort of military equipment to Ukraine on February 23rd of last year, how different that would have been perceived by Russia and other allies.
Absolutely. And that was, you were just talking about the question of why it took so long to ramp up military aid to Ukraine. And, you know, certainly in retrospect, it looks like and it feels like a major failure not to have given Ukraine more weapons and better weapons much, much earlier. And this is, of course, a debate that goes all the way back at least to 2014, when Russia annexed to Crimea and when Russia instigated and spurred and supported separatists in other parts of eastern Ukraine. These questions about what weapons, if any, should the U.S. and NATO be giving Ukraine to fight Russia became, a major debate. And at that point, there was serious concern that, as of that point, Russia was, they had annexed Crimea, but they had done so quickly and without a lot of bloodshed. And as horrific as that was, the West didn't have the appetite for a head-on collision with Russia. And the sense was, as of right now, Russia's not asking for that. So if we back Ukraine, even with javelins and things like this, is Russia going to perceive that as this conflict that it kind of seemed to be bracing for of West versus Russia? And that was the argument that essentially kept aid from going in a significant. I mean, we did training and there was lots that we did for Ukraine, but we did not send serious weapons. And that debate basically kept things, in a way that was it was difficult for political reasons, even in the U.S., but certainly in Europe, to imagine putting in serious weapons. Now, in retrospect, after February 24th, everybody who was on that side, of saying we've got to be careful, had to backtrack a little bit and say this looks horrific. It really would have been much better now, knowing what we know, that Russia was going to attack anyways, to give Ukraine everything it needed. But that's hindsight, of course. And at the time, that was a very serious consideration, that let's not be part of the cause of Russia's escalation. If Russia escalates, then we respond, but we're not going to be the one to provoke them.
Speaking of Russia's escalation or responses, what do you make of these strikes that are still taking place? So the fighting is mostly in the east, and I should say we need to take a break in a couple of minutes here. But Russia has been, conducting strikes on cities across the country intermittently. A horrific one, particularly in Dnipro, which is a city that we have followed because there's a woman in central Illinois we've spoken to a couple of times on the show who is from Dnipro. She says none of her family, I checked in with her after this, none of her family was hurt. But obviously it was a significant blow to the sort of psyche of that city. What is Russia playing at with that?
Yeah, this has been really horrific throughout, the extent to which Russia seems to make very little effort to distinguish between civilian attacks on civilians and attacks on military installations. And of course, they cynically use the same sort of language that Western armies use and say, yes, it's these are unfortunate casualties, but there was a military target and we just accidentally collateral damage or something. But that's clearly not the case. They've just indiscriminately attacked civilians, and there's several parts of this. One has been this misguided idea that you can basically scare and the Ukrainians into surrendering, that you know, if you just have to live for long enough under the threat of missiles, that you will no longer be willing to fight. But that's completely backfired. As you know from talking to Ukrainians, as horrific as this has been, it has just steeled resolve and essentially created unity among Ukrainians, saying we're not going to give in after this. We're going to take back as much of our country as possible, rather than be blackmailed. And then the second part, and I'll say this just quickly, is this isn't what happened in Dnipro, but the part that has been more strategic has been the targeting of civilian infrastructure, so electricity and such, under the idea of, again, trying to make it so miserable that Ukrainians are no longer willing to fight. And that hasn't succeeded, but what has succeeded is it directs attention and effort and resources away from fighting into restoring electricity, getting, you know, water running again, getting just basic life going, and that makes it that much harder to fight.
All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to continue our conversation on Ukraine with Jordan Gans-Morse, who is at Northwestern University and an expert on Eastern Europe. He's director of the Russian, faculty director of the Russian Eurasian and East European Studies program there. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about the war in Ukraine, Russia's war against Ukraine, in the 12th month since Russia really escalated a war that arguably began back in 2014 with the annexation of Crimea. We're talking about this with Jordan Gans-Morse, who's Associate Professor of Political Science and Faculty Director of the Russian, Eurasian, and East European Studies Program at Northwestern University. If you have a question about the U.S. role in this war, support for Ukraine, if you have an opinion on whether there ought to be a cap on our support for Ukraine, as some in Congress are suggesting, if you just have a general question about what's happening there or a comment, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You know, I want to ask you, you mentioned that we were talking before the break about some of the airstrikes and other types of attacks around the country, attempting to weaken the resolve of the Ukrainian people. And I think before this conflict, there were predictions that this was going to be, as a New York Times columnist recently called it, a kind of postmodern war, right, with media manipulation and disinformation and cyber attacks. And we've seen some of that, but I don't think it's really dominated as much as tanks and urban assaults and the things that we're used to. And that was the point the New York Times columnist was making. What do you make of that? The fact that, I mean, that, you know, there's been a lot of attention in this country to Russia's cyber warfare ability, especially given the discussion around our elections here and the Russian bots on Twitter and that sort of thing. Are you surprised by how it's developed?
Yes and no. It is really a strange war in this respect, in that in some ways it's this barbaric, almost World War One type war with trenches and tanks and types of things that we just haven't seen in many decades for the most part, because as much as there's, you know, wars have never ceased around the world, they've been they haven't been this kind of too traditional industrial backed armies clashing at this type of intensity in a really long time, and that all looks like old school war. Then you mentioned the types of things that we expected that sometimes falls under this rubric that you know is controversial in terms of its name of hybrid warfare, but that involves everything from cyber attacks to misinformation and so on. The first thing I would say about that latter part is it has happened. I think we don't see as much of it for several reasons. One is that Ukraine, and probably with help from the West, but Ukraine itself deserves respect for this, has countered it pretty effectively. And so it's not that Russia did not launch cyber attacks on Ukraine. It certainly has. It's that Ukraine has parried them quite well. And so that's part of it. And then the other part is probably Russia's overconfidence played a role here as well. A lot of us certainly thought that pretty quickly, Ukraine would lose access to the internet, for example. And of course, there's, you know, Starlink was sent over there, and some things like this have played some role to have satellite internet and things like this. But also Russia seemed to be hesitant to initially destroy some of this infrastructure because they thought they were going to roll in and then be able to use it. And of course, that's not what happened. So it's part strategy, part that there's a lot of countering that we don't quite realize maybe occurred. And so it looks like nothing happened. But in fact, an attack happened, a counterattack happened, and things kept working more or less to those of us who are looking at this from the outside. So there has been some of that. But the final thing I'd say about this is that there really is still a postmodern aspect, if we want to call it that. It's not necessarily the hybrid warfare and the cyber attacks and the misinformation, all that. That's all certainly there. It's the fact that the drones are everywhere, that and not just drones that are military caliber. I mean, certainly those are being used, but they're just drones that people can buy at basic stores, right, are being purchased all over the world by both sides. Russians themselves are crowdsourcing and getting drones sent to their troops, and Ukrainians and their supporters all over the world are getting, are purchasing drones sometimes, you know, for millions of dollars that they buy from, say, Turkey on a military caliber, but others are just being, bought in commercial stores and adapted to the use for war. And you see, you know, these crazy things that are rigged up and then put on Twitter to make this even more postmodern, right, where you have just a commercial drone that's been rigged up by Ukrainian soldiers to drop a grenade on Russians, and it's videotaped and then it's sent all over social media. That aspect of seeing this type of things in on social media in real time is very unusual, I think. And even more than that is because the internet has stayed active, the connections that people have had. I mean, I'm running surveys in Ukraine right now, through online survey companies. That's remarkable, right? I mean, that's not something I think probably historically that's ever been possible, where we have real-time information from people who are in the middle of a war that really is an old-school war on the one hand, but that's pretty new-school and postmodern to have that type of connection at the same time.
It is remarkable, especially if you follow the right people on Twitter, for example. It has been just an invaluable and seemingly unprecedented window into what's happening over there. On the other hand, that's here in the West. What do everyday Russians understand about how the war is going today?
It's hard to say because, here is the part where our information has been, for those of us who watch this part of the world, has been really cut off. I mean, there certainly are still surveys going on in Russia, and they do ask these types of questions about support for the war. But of course, they have to be heavily censored to be allowed to run and to not put people in danger. As you probably know, it is a crime in Russia currently even call this a war. It is still a special military operation, quote unquote. And so, for those of us who run surveys in Russia, for all the professional survey firms, they use that terminology. There's been Russia already had cracked down significantly on freedom of the press, all throughout Putin's, 20 plus years in power, but especially in recent years. And that got amped up to unprecedented levels for the post-Soviet period as soon as this war began. So Russians have been fed a pretty steady diet, particularly those who are reliant on, so older people or people who are less educated and reliant basically on state television and state media. They've been fed this steady diet of propaganda about how Russia's in Ukraine on this limited operation to help Russian speakers and ethnic Russians who are being mistreated by Ukrainian Nazis. And either people seem to buy it or they seem to be apathetic enough about it to say, just as long as this isn't going to affect me, I don't want to think too hard about this. Now, when Russia in the fall mobilized over 100,000 people, in addition to the troops that they had initially sent in, that changed things dramatically because people directly had to be confronted by the fact that they themselves might get sent. And that's when we saw some of this apathy break, but it did not necessarily turn into some sort of widespread disagreement with the war. It turned more into a sense of, I got to do whatever I can to save myself from having to go fight, or save my family from having to go fight, but I'm not turning against the war in general.
We got a question from a listener who did not want to go on air, but was wondering, when we talk about aid to Ukraine, money that we're giving Ukraine, right, as the United States, not individual people donating maybe to a charity or something, I gather, but how much of that is really going back to U.S. companies for weapons and the like? Is that what's really meant by foreign aid?
I'm so glad that question was asked. I wanted to actually bring this up because you know, when you've been posing this question to the listeners of you know, do you support this for the long term? Should there be a cap on aid and so on? I think that there's been a significant mischaracterization, particularly by Republicans in Congress, about what this money is used for, and the sense that yes, this is billions of dollars. These are billions of dollars that are just being handed over to the Ukrainians to do whatever they'd like to do with it. And that of course is not what's happening at all. There's a small fraction of these billions of dollars that we see announced by the Biden administration or by Congress saying, you know, another X billion dollars is being allocated to support Ukraine. A fraction of that is going to the Ukrainian government to use for, you know, helping to keep education running or healthcare running and these types of things, because they of course are starving for funds, given that they're fighting this war, that their economy has been attacked and so on. But a large part of this is going, some of it is literally going just to pay our military bills, because we are spending, you know, doing things with the military that we hadn't budgeted for prior to this war. So, you know, moving more troops into Eastern Europe, that can be part of this money. Other parts of it are to basically either, you know, for the longer term, be purchasing new weapons. And yes, that's going to be basically giving U.S. people jobs. I mean, and in the sense of most of it, not 100%, but most of that is going to go to U.S. military contractors. Some of this would be counted towards things that the U.S. has already built. You know, these are military equipment or weapons that we are sending to Ukraine using what's called presidential drawdowns, which means that we are taking, you know, the president has the authority basically to take things that are from our military and give it to Ukraine, but that has to be covered somehow and has to be replaced somehow. That is part of our aid. So there's all sorts of ways that this is basically staying in U.S. hands or even going into the U.S. private sector in the form of military contracts and gets counted as aid to Ukraine. And so I think that's really important when there's the sense that you know, the U.S. is losing lots of money on this. That's not really the case. And that's leaving aside, you know, entirely the whole second question that relates to this, which is, you know, even if we were just taking, you know, billions of dollars and giving to Ukraine, is that a good deal in terms of spending for national security for the United States? I would argue categorically yes, but that's a separate question. That's not even what we're doing. We're giving some money directly to Ukraine. Much of this stays in U.S. hands or goes to the U.S. private sector.
And do you... Okay, so that's about the money. And I think this is probably true of a lot of military aid, right? Or foreign aid, as we call it, is often just spending on U.S. military equipment that's sent over. Let's talk, though, and we have about 6.5 minutes left in our conversation, but about these corruption-related firings and resignations, I guess, of Ukrainian officials that we've seen in the last week. I, of course, cannot help but be reminded that former President Trump's first impeachment was tangentially related to corruption or alleged corruption among Ukrainian officials. What does that say about this conflict? Talk more about that.
Yeah, I think that, you know, this is going to be a super important topic from the perspective of politics, because corruption, of course, has been a problem in Ukraine prior to this war, and Russia has pushed this narrative a lot, and so they're going to do everything they can to put out information to undermine Western support by making it sound like this money is being wasted. But we should be clear about several things. You know, what exactly happened, how it was uncovered, and what response was. So the types of things that we're talking about are classic, you know, schemes where the military is paying too much money to its suppliers, and probably part of that is that somebody in the military procurement process in Ukraine is getting a kickback in order to basically make these contracts bigger than they should happen. Now, and this happens all throughout the West as well. I mean, there's been plenty of scandals where our own Defense Department, you know, has been, if not through bribery, just through, you know, too tight of connections and things like this, has been paying inflated prices. Now, when you're in the middle of a war, that's a national security risk, and that's really problematic. But how did this get uncovered? This got uncovered because Ukrainian journalists, because the media is free there, found out about it. And a Ukrainian anti-government and anti-corruption activist, because civil society is free there, have been pushing hard to monitor these types of things. And so they brought that into the public sphere, and immediately Zelensky reacted the same way you would hope that a politician in any democracy that's functioning well would act, which is he acted on this, and these people were fired, and some of them may be prosecuted. And so to me, this is overall a good sign. This is what you would want to see in a functioning democracy, is that to the extent that something is not working, activists and the media bring it to the public's attention, and the president does what he should do. And so this is the conundrum of anti-corruption, right? Which is that in order to fight corruption, you sometimes have to bring it into the light, but bringing it into the light makes people think there's a problem. And really what this is showing is that there's a problem just like there is everywhere. And by that, consider the amount of money that the U.S. government lost to fraud in terms of COVID relief. It's in the billions. And we're still trying to track that down. And so this happens when lots of money is floating around. And the question is, do you do a good job responding? And so far, Ukraine is showing that, yes, they are.
Just a few minutes left in our conversation, and I'm going to ask you to speculate a little bit. But what do you think the end of this conflict looks like?
A lot of that depends on some contingencies, including first and foremost, the West, just in that makes it sound like the Ukrainians don't deserve the credit for what has happened, and they do. I mean, they were the ones when nobody expected them to be able to fend off a major full-scale invasion from Russia, push Russia back in the Battle of Kyiv, and then when nobody expected them to be able to deal with this war of attrition when Russia was shelling them heavily all throughout the late spring and the summer, and then went on the counteroffensive and took back Kharkiv and took back Kherson, they're the ones who are dying. They're the ones at the heart of this. But a lot of what happens next does depend on keeping Western support to bring in these next level weapons, right? So we see the tanks, and you mentioned air power and things like this. They need more artillery because they're firing these weapons so much that they need to be replaced, and they need defense from air attacks. If all that happens, I think there's a very good chance that Ukraine continues to be successful in the counteroffensive and throughout this year. Whether that means they can push Russia all the way out of the Donbass, that's the big question, because as you get, as you get down to defending a smaller and smaller area, it gets that much easier to do so. And whether that means that they try to take back Crimea, and if they do, if they succeed, that's the really difficult thing to predict, because even those who support Ukraine in the Western governments are much more divided about whether Ukraine should go after Crimea or not than they are about pushing Russia all the way out of the Donbass. But I do think that if we maintain our support, Ukraine will be successful in pushing further counteroffensives. How far that will go, I think we'll know fairly soon, probably by summer.
Right. 2014 borders means not having Crimea. 1991, I guess you could go back to, if they're completely successful, as some Ukrainians would have it. Just about a minute left. Do you see Ukraine in the future becoming an ally, I guess a NATO member, or an ally at least on par with America's non-NATO allies, Japan, Australia, that sort of country?
I think it has to. Whether it joins NATO is a complicated question, certainly not one for less than a minute. But I think that in terms of at least being a critical non-NATO ally, and possibly joining NATO someday, but at least being a critical non-NATO ally, it absolutely has to be. If the U.S. is going, and if NATO itself is going to basically contain Russia, and that for now, at least until we see what happens at some point when Putin is replaced from power, and whether that's sooner or later, that for now is going to be the reality, is that Russia has acted belligerently in a way that we have not seen by a major power since World War II. And for the foreseeable future, we have to deal with that, and Ukraine has to be at the center of that.
Well, Jordan Gansmoris, you handled the big picture question with less than a minute remaining very well, and I certainly feel a lot smarter than I did 40 minutes ago. Thanks so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
It's my pleasure, and thanks so much for keeping Ukraine in the news. It's important not just to them, but to the security of the United States and the security of Europe, and so I always appreciate it when people keep Americans' eye on this.
Yeah, well, thanks again for coming. Hope we can talk to you again soon. Jordan Gansmoris is Associate Professor of Political Science and Faculty Director of the Russian, Eurasian, and East European Studies Program at Northwestern University. Coming up after a short break, we're going to be talking about that alleged case of arson at the Planned Parenthood Clinic in Peoria. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us.